From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 25th day of October, 2017. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with John Newton. He's at the AFBF, that's the American Farm Bureau Federation, out of Washington, D.C. Actually traveling this week, he's been in Kansas City at USDA's Data Users Group. We'll discuss some of that with him and then, of course, take up the marketplace as well. Jackie Vakes is out of the office. A bit later in the program, we'll check in with the folks at the Anderson's Climbers facility outside of Logansport, Indiana. They produce ethanol there. Check the cash grain markets, and as we finish our time out together, we'll take a look at the weather forecast, too. Drew Lerner from World Weather Incorporated will join us on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
This is the Closing Market Report for Wednesday afternoon. It's the 25th day of October. Do pick up your tickets to the Farm Assets Conference. That's the Tuesday prior to Thanksgiving, the 21st day of the month. Should be a really good day. Looking forward to having you there. Tickets are just $35. You can pick them up at willag.org, online at farmassetsconference.com, or by calling 1-800-898-1065. That's 800-898-1065. John Newton now joins us. He's with the American Farm Bureau Federation and is traveling this week, has been outside of Washington, D.C., into Kansas. I think you were in Kansas City at the Data Users Group for USDA. John, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's always good to jump back on the radio with you.
Well, I've been to the Data Users Group once. This is USDA putting together a slideshow event of sorts that folks who use their data, meaning mostly for our cases, crop production and weekly crop progress reports and the WASI numbers and such, and some other numbers, and to have some interaction with them. What'd you learn this week?
Well, you know, one of the things that we learned this week, and we already knew this before, but we have access to some of the best data and best information in agricultural commodity markets out of any country in the world. And I think everybody recognizes that, but we also have some challenges. And so we had the opportunity at the data users meeting to learn more about the process that USDA uses in determining some of the information, the survey process, what they're doing to make their information better and more accessible to users. But the big item that was the topic of conversation most of the day really dealt with the crop progress report. There was a lot of concern that the crop conditions didn't really match that first yield number that we saw this year, and that really moved the market. And folks wanted to express that concern to USDA, learn more about how USDA derives those ratings. But that was a really interesting topic of conversation there.
Did they have much of an explanation for the difference between what the crop progress number showed and what the first crop production report showed in August?
Yeah, they did. You know, USDA, NASS, you know, the crop yield estimates are based on surveys, whereas the condition ratings are based on, they have a group of people that maybe drive around, look at it from the road. It's not the same statistical procedure that you see with crop yield. So it's more of a subjective measure as opposed to the more analytical process that they use for yields, where they're using survey data, satellite imagery, et cetera. The crop conditions report's really much more subjective. And this year, the ratings were so poor. Farmers really didn't expect to see the first yield number that USDA put out. I think the market was expecting more about 166, 168. And when USDA came out so high, I mean, that really impacted the markets. And so folks really wanted to communicate that disparity moved markets. And we need to make sure we understand better what exactly is that crop condition information. And some people even advocated for getting rid of the crop condition reports. I think the audience was partially mixed on that. I know we like to see that information put out by USDA on a weekly basis, because it gives us some indication of what the crop may ultimately look like. But now that we know better how the information is derived, it helps inform our thinking about what production could be at the end of the crop year.
What did they say about how they train their enumerators that do the weekly crop progress report?
You know, they said, you know, it's it may not often be the same person that's looking at the crop. I think they say they have about 2,000 people that are out looking at the fields for that crop condition report. But it's, again, it's more subjective, and it's not an analytical procedure. They're not in there looking at the ears or anything like that. So the crop can look pretty good from the road, but you get in the fields, they can look a lot worse, but they're not in the fields doing that.
So this question, was it driven by the data users or by USDA or both? Did they expect it?
I think they expected it. You know, it's and USDA probably got a courtesy heads up that, hey, the industry is really concerned on that crop condition report. And so the data users were the ones that brought it to the attention. I think USDA knew it was coming. I mean, they knew the market reacted the way it did with the crop yield data that we got earlier this year.
What else did you learn?
Well, we learned that USDA is rolling out a lot of things to make information more accessible to users. The Economic Research Service is loading a lot of interactive tools. The Foreign Ag Service has a lot of interactive tools. And they're going to load a new tool online soon called GADIS. That's satellite imagery data of the United States. You can look at vegetative indexes and things of that nature. And we also learned from the Farm Service Agency the kind of information that they're putting out, their acreage data, and also learned about some of the ways that USDA is making their information available to developers through application programming interfaces so that information can be gathered and analyzed much, much faster.
Oh, interesting. So I suspect we'll see some new tools being offered by services for AFBF, for instance, or Allendale or other places that might put together these services. That could very well be interesting. Now let's turn our attention to the commodity markets directly. I know you've been watching the price of corn and soybeans. After that USDA report, we had a couple of good days up, and then things have been challenging since then for soybeans in particular. What do you see in the marketplace today?
You know, it's tough. It's been sideways for a while. The market knows what we've got. We're going to have the third biggest corn crop in U.S. history. We're going to have a record soybean crop, and we've got a lot of corn sitting in bins around the country. So you don't see a big demand driver coming into that market that's pushing these prices a lot higher. So I think we're going to be in this flat price environment for a while. You know, 350, 360 corn. You know, until next spring, I don't see much. That could really move the market from a fundamentals perspective to a higher level. There was some concern, you know, over the RFS, but we, you know, we did get some certainty from Administrator Pruitt that he's going to make that program work for U.S. agriculture and make it work better. So that provides some support, especially on the corn-based ethanol side of the equation. I know there was some concern, you know, on soy-based biodiesel, as it's used as an advanced biofuel. The potential to roll that back and what that could have done to soy oil prices and effectively demand for soybeans. I'm much more optimistic on soybeans. You know, we continue to move beans to China. China estimates that within the next 5 years, they're going to import more soybeans than we produce in the entire United States. So, you know, I'm very optimistic on the bean side of the equation. I think we'll continue to move that product overseas. But we're stuck in that $9 to $10 range for now. You know, but I think as this new crop starts to get used, and we'll see that inventory number continue to come down over the season, that provides some positive price outlook as we go forward.
So your bias then is that as futures months expire, that prices will drop from the out months to meet whatever that future month expiry might be.
I think that, you know, now's not the time to really sell a lot of beans. I think the price can get better later in the year. on the corn side of the equation, I think we're stuck in that sideways pattern.
What else is on your mind today? Anything?
You know, this is a pretty interesting observation. I had the opportunity last week to visit Malaysia and Singapore. And visit palm oil plantations. And palm oil is the largest plant-based oil seed, but its major competitor is soybean oil. And so they're very interested in the U.S. soybean complex because of the amount of soybeans we export to China, which ultimately gets crushed and used in their domestic market. And it's offsetting Chinese consumers' use of palm oil. And so there's just considerable growth. The Europeans are rolling back their use of palm oil, using more soybean oils. And then the other interesting observation over there is there's a strong demand for organically produced soybeans in that country. Consumers want that product. And I think it provides an opportunity for U.S. Farmers if the cost, the premiums for those organically produced soybeans are there and the yield drag is worth it, there's a marketing opportunity in that space as well.
John, always good to talk with you.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. You got to get me back out to Champaign. I miss it.
I'll see what I can do, John. John Newton, of course, is with the American Farm Bureau Federation. He's based out of Washington, D.C. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report. You can find us online at willag.org and pick up your tickets to the Farm Assets Conference there or at farmassetsconference.com, 800-898-1065. Tickets are just $35. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Farmers deal with the United States Department of Agriculture in many ways. One of them is through crop insurance. Gary Schnitke is a specialist and an ag economist here on the U of I campus and has written an article about enterprise units across county lines. This is something farmers have dealt with for some time, not very happily much of the time. What's been the problem over the years?
So, yeah. Farmers' crop insurance units are county specific. So if a farmer's insuring, they're going to insure in one county and then another county will be a separate policy. And many farmers use enterprise units, which is all of one crop in one county. And they have expressed desires to have enterprise units that cross county lines. So in a survey with the Illinois Corn Growers Association, we looked at that possibility or what they thought of those possibilities.
And so there was a survey, and actually you had nearly 400 respondents, which was a pretty good response, I would assume.
Yes, so Illinois Corn Growers Association sponsored the survey, sent the survey out electronically to its members, and we got 398 responses from that. It dealt totally with the enterprise or insurance unit issue.
And of those, how many grew corn in more than one county?
So we had 398 farmers, or take the survey, 40% of those grew more in more than one county. So 40% of the farmers grew in more than one county. 64% of that 40% grew in two counties, 8% in three counties, and 8% had corn in four more counties.
And how many of them used enterprise units of the 40%?
So 75% of those farmers used enterprise units in at least one of the counties. So if you were in one county, that would mean you had one enterprise unit. And if you had more than one, you might have a basic or optional unit in some other county, maybe because you're ineligible for an enterprise unit.
Does this appear to represent how crop insurance works in the state of Illinois?
Yeah, so if you look at the crop insurance in the state of Illinois, we had 75% of the farmers saying they had enterprise units. RP, if you look at those policies, 66% of the premium was associated with enterprise units. So, you know, roughly the same, a little bit higher, but roughly the same.
And how did the farmers use their crop insurance and enterprise units?
So we had 78% of the farms had enterprise units in two or more counties, and we asked them, would you be willing to combine those two enterprise units, two or more enterprise units, into one enterprise unit that spanned the county line, so multi-county enterprise unit. And over 60% of them said yes, they would be willing to do that. In general, that would result in them getting less insurance payments, and as a result, the total premium would be less as well, because you would expect the total premium to go down because of lower insurance payments.
So they were inclined because of the lower insurance payments, because of less paperwork because of it all, or do we know?
We didn't particularly ask them why they would want to do that. I suspect it's a combination of all of those. If you would expect to have a lower premium, the paperwork would be less, and those two combinations. I suspect that right now, with our tight economic environment, those lower premiums look pretty attractive.
And did you ask why of those producers who were unwilling to combine into one unit, why they were unwilling?
So we said if you combine the two enterprise units in one, you would get a 10% premium reduction. 36% of the farmers said they would need more than that 10% to do that. And others indicated that they used different insurance products and coverage levels across county lines, and they thought that was important for their risk management options.
How about whole farm units?
So whole farm units is a combination of, it would be combining corn and soybeans. We asked if they would be willing to do that, and roughly 63% indicated they would. What's sort of surprising about that is there is a whole farm unit available. So for whatever reason, they're not willing to do that. We didn't go into a whole lot of reasons why they wouldn't be willing to do that, but it might be because the premium isn't low enough in their point, or you know, combining two farms or two crops is always a bit more complicated.
How do you summarize it, and are there next steps?
So the summary of this is that we see a lot of farmers willing to combine in more aggregate units than enterprise units. That's either across county lines or multi-county enterprise units, or taking basic and optional units and combining them, and also looking at whole farm units. All of those would tend to have the impact of reducing premium to farmers, and it would also have the impact of lowering cost. So this is something that may be a farm bill sort of issue that, as we're moving forward, we can think about this as a way to help both farmers and taxpayers.
And so it would be lower cost across the board for farmers and for taxpayers both.
That's correct.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That, of course, Gary Schnitke, agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. If you'd like to read more about this, you can do it on the FarmDoc website at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Look for either Gary Schnitke's name or the title, Farmers' Desires for Enterprise Units Across County Lines. This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's the 25th day of October. Drew Lerner is here. He's with World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. Drew, let's start in South America today. What are weather conditions like in Brazil, Argentina, and places in between?
Well, we're certainly playing around with rainfall. That's everything that everyone's talking about, of course, but yet has it really rained that much? And the answer to that is really not. From Minas Gerais over towards Mato Grosso, which is kind of center-west into the center-south crop areas, that we're still fighting dryness. It's not absolutely dry. We are making progress in the fields, but they do need a good amount of rain in order to really get this crop off and running. And we're not going to see that right away. We're going to see additional isolated and scattered showers of limited significance occurring for at least the next 2 or 3 days, and then we'll start increasing rainfall perhaps over the weekend and into next week. Part of the problem is there's going to be quite a heavy rain event occurring in the interior south of Brazil and parts of western Paraná and portions of southern Mato Grosso do Sul and neighboring areas. Some of that region will end up with 3 to 6 and local 9-inch amounts of rain by Sunday. With all the energy in the atmosphere focused on that region, it's going to cheat the rest of the country for moisture for a little while. But next week, everything was going to relax a little bit. We'll see something a little bit more normal for the country, whatever that may be. Argentina, a good mix of weather for the next 10 days to 2 weeks. Really, the conditions down there look ideal for many areas. There are some pockets of dryness in the northwest and some areas that are a little too wet still, but we're probably going to see this all even out a little bit as we go forward through the two-week period. So it's not a bad scenario in South America.
So I suppose importantly to think about this geographically, Brazil is big. like the United States in terms of its primary cropping areas. Are there places, and you mentioned Mato Grosso, which is a primary soybean production source in that nation, are there areas within Mato Grosso, other places that really do need rainfall and might be suffering at this point?
Well, definitely there are some locations in Mato Grosso and Goiás, both. Those are the two northwesternmost production areas, and of course Mato Grosso represents a huge amount of soybeans. So there are definitely some areas that are too dry, where emergence and establishment have been very poor. In fact, we've probably withered some of the crop and lost a little bit of it because it's been too hot and dry in recent weeks, but we are starting to see some improvement gradually. They will have to replant a small part of that crop, and they'll also have to replant a small part of this area that's going to get the flooding rainfall this weekend.
And how much of a concern then on the backside of it is this for second crop corn?
Well, definitely we have to watch real closely. We are 3 to 4 weeks late in some cases in Mato Grosso for getting some of this crop in the ground. That can have a huge impact on the back end of the growing season. If they have problems with too much rain during the harvest in late January and February, then they're going to be late getting that second crop in, and then we run the risk of running out of rainfall at the end of the season. Normally the monsoon rains end in late March and April, and if we are 3 weeks late getting that new crop in the ground, there's going to be a fairly good chance that they're going to run out of moisture for the reproductive part of that second season crop. So there's very definitely a concern there. We do have a La Nina event building, and La Nina events do tend to extend the growing season a little bit with better rainfall at the end. So we'll see how that all comes together.
Turn your attention to the United States. Now let's focus on the northwestern corner of the Corn Belt. Minnesota has been lagging behind in particular in harvest. Do they have better conditions over the next week and a half?
Well, yes and no. You know, the biggest concern in the upper Midwest and the Great Lakes region for that matter is that we're going to see a frequent succession of weak weather systems coming through that will produce a high frequency of light snow and rain, both. And it'll occur almost every day or every other day across some of these areas. It'll be cold, so we won't be able to dry the soil very quickly. And so the end result is that there's going to be some delay in getting back into these fields. You know, parts of Michigan have just received, to goodness, multiple inches of rain over this past weekend. The ground is totally saturated down into northern parts of Illinois and northern Indiana, and so these areas are not going to get a chance to dry down for another week to week and a half because there will be additional precipitation coming up and a persistence of rather cool weather with highs in the 40s and 50s. Might even be one day or two that are only in the 30s. So not a good scenario for late season farming activity in those areas.
Do you think that soils are wet enough now that it's keeping producers out of the field at this point?
In those areas I just mentioned for Michigan, yes, maybe a small part of northeastern Illinois, and we have had problems in some places in Iowa and Minnesota, but I do think that they're going to see enough drying conditions that they'll be able to get into some of the marginally wet areas. But there are still going to be some areas that are going to be wet, and they're going to be out of those fields for a while.
Hey, thanks so much.
All right, have a good day.
You too. Drew Lerner, of course, is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.